You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia, and of course, I'm assisted by my lovely co-host, Paula Lauzon. And Paula, what is the weather like up in Boston today? Because you're broadcasting live from Boston. I'm broadcasting live from South Florida. What's it like in Boston?
I'll tell you what, it's a shock because I had to check three different places. The temperature right now is 27 degrees. It's clear, but it's 27.
Wow.
But you know what that was like living up there in New Hampshire all those years.
Oh, yeah. Jeez Louise. I don't even know what to say. 27 degrees. Yeah, it was around 80 degrees. I mean, we just got home at 7... You know, just it's 7 o'clock now, and it was, I think, driving in the car, it said it was about 78, 79.
Oh, stop already.
When you said 27, my first thought was Celsius, because as a pilot, we don't get our printouts in the out of the computer on the airplane in Fahrenheit anymore. It comes out in Celsius.
Oh,
so I'm always
good.
Converting in my mind. When you said 27, my first thought was like, my gosh, that's really warm. Because 27 that's, would be about, 80 degrees.
I mentioned that wonderful metric system that we're supposed to be learning, but we don't know.
Yeah. So, anyway, we got some things to talk about today. We're going to start off with some humor, but then I'm going to talk briefly about the Keystone Pipeline. We know what's going on with that, but we're going to, in case anybody hasn't been paying attention, Keystone Pipeline, we're going to talk about the government and its balanced approach to stealing more of your money. But that's what the libtards keep saying. We got to have a balanced approach. We got to have a balanced approach. So we're going to talk about that because it's a totally imbalanced approach. And finally, Obamacare. What happens if the Supreme Court rules that it's constitutional? We'll talk about why it's not constitutional and how the Supreme Court, if they rule that Obamacare is constitutional, they have just undone their own authority forever. So we'll talk about that. But in any case, Paul, it's always good to start off with some humor. And I know that you've got some humor for us, some jokes and some other one-liners and from late-night shows and other things. So take it away, Paula.
There's a couple of good things from the shows from Friday evening on The Tonight Show with Jay Letterman. Mitt Romney has moved up to 40% in New Hampshire for two reasons, Herman Cain and Rick Perry. Herman Cain is being criticized for his lack of knowledge on foreign affairs, but he denies that he lacks expertise in that area. In fact, today, Cain said when he becomes president, first thing he's going to do is go to Iraq, meet with Saddam Hussein personally, and get this whole thing worked out.
Yeah. Okay, the spirit of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah. At a town hall meeting in New Hampshire on Thursday, Rick Perry said that no illegal immigrants would be allowed to attend. In fact, the event was held in an overgrown backyard with nobody to park the cars and nobody to watch the kids.
Nice.
On Conan, the House of Representatives has passed a bill that would allow people to carry a concealed weapon from one state to another. In other words, the trip back to Boston for Thanksgiving just got a lot more interesting.
You know, speaking of Conan O'Brien, it was funny. I wanted the new Conan movie comes out tomorrow, and I wanted to see what, you know, people thought of it, because it's coming out on DVD, not on, you know, at the theater, but on DVD. So I thought, is it going to be worth renting? And when you pull it up on either Rotten Tomatoes, or if you have an iPhone and you use Flixster uses Rotten Tomatoes as its way of giving you reviews and things. The new Conan movie got a 37% approval rating from viewers.
Mm-hmm.
The original Conan with Arnold Schwarzenegger, with minimal dialogue, terrible acting, etc., got a 67% approval rating. And Conan O'Brien got a 75% approval rating for his stand-up. So it was funny to see Conan the Barbarian, and then Conan the stand-up comic. And Conan the stand-up comic got the best rating of anybody.
Like, all that big hair he's got going on.
Yeah, he's Irish too, so that always helps.
Of course. Late Show with David Letterman. The Occupy Wall Street people are so angry at Mayor Bloomberg, and it's starting to look really bad for his seventh term.
Yeah, that guy. You know what? New Yorkers get what they deserve. Really.
Well, you know. Over the weekend, a gentleman took a shot at the White House. They hunted him down and arrested him. He said that he thought he had a better shot at it than those Republican candidates.
Not anymore. Boy.
See, late show with Craig Ferguson. President Obama quit smoking this year. It wasn't easy. He had to ask the Republicans for permission first.
Yeah, now that's right.
I thought you would say that.
Yeah, no, we're gonna talk about something tonight about the Republicans that with their balanced budget amendment. You know, you probably heard a little bit about that, Paula. But it's not a balanced budget amendment, quite honestly. It is, but it isn't. It's a way of raising taxes on us, and then they can claim that they had no control over it. It's really despicable. So the Republicans, led by John Boehner, I don't know what's wrong with John Boehner. I don't know what his agenda is, what his deal is. He's either really stupid or he's really evil, one of the two. Neither are good. So, yeah, you're hearing me say that. You're hearing me say that. I'll say that stuff about libtards and Democrats, but we got some Republican problems. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, anyway. All right. What else, Paula?
Let's see. The other night, again with Jay Leno a couple of nights back, people say Herman Cain was rambling and embarrassed himself while trying to answer a question about Libya. Some say it proves he's not qualified to be president, but the good news is rambling and embarrassing himself does qualify him to be vice president.
Yeah, it does. It qualifies him to be a senator, but it does make him specifically the dumbest senator in the history of our nation and the dumbest vice president that we've ever had. So he gets those two distinctions. In addition to, yes, vice presidents don't have to be real smart. And that's maybe that's why they picked Joe Biden. They're like, hey, who's the dumbest guy in the Senate we could pick to be the vice president? Well, Joe Biden, it's clear. I don't think you could take a poll. Mark Levin was doing a poll. He was doing a poll saying, who's the dumbest vice president we've ever had? A, Joe Biden. B, Joe Biden. C, Joe Biden. D, all the above. He said the overwhelming response so far was D, all the above.
Well, Cain's only real foreign policy experience is from where he ran the National Restaurant Association and had to deal with the manager from IHOP.
God. Oh, boy. Yeah, that's like, you know, Palm Beach International Airport's just 25 minutes from my house. It's international airport because it flies to they have airplanes that fly to Bahamas.
Uh-huh.
It's international, so it qualifies them to be an international airport. Whatever.
Let's see. People attending a Rick Perry event in New Hampshire had to prove they were American citizens. They asked a math or science question, and if you get it wrong, you were born here.
Well, that's like Obama over in Australia telling the kids there. He's visiting some kids in school, and he says, yeah, the kids in my country, they're behind. They're not doing so good, not too bright. Now, that's not exactly what he said, but he said, you know, they're falling behind or they've fallen behind. Wow. Does this guy ever go abroad and say anything nice about America? Ever? My gosh. I don't even know why he lives in America. Why would you want to be president of the United States of America if you think it's so crappy? And he's had, you know, 3.5 years to make it better, but it's not. But of course it's not his fault. I heard a great line today. You know, if any jobs are created, Obama created them, But if we lose any jobs, oh, Bush's fault, rich people's fault, big bad oil company's fault, middle class fault, lazy Americans' fault, dumb school kids' fault. I've been pointing this out for a couple of years now, but I have never seen anybody in a leadership position not only make as many excuses as this guy makes, but point the finger constantly at other people. It's never his fault. And the vast majority of the problems we're having today, not 3 years ago, but today, are his fault. So anyway, that's when you talk about students, yeah. We may have some educational problems, but you don't go around the world broadcasting. You know the old story about dirty laundry. You don't air your dirty laundry out there in you know, your front yard. It's back in the backyard where your neighbors can't see it. But not this president. Nope, he wants to air it all over the place. Make sure everybody sees it. So anyway, all right. Well, let's talk about the balanced budget amendment. Now, everybody thinks, oh, the Republicans are trying to balance the budget and create a constitutional balanced budget amendment so that the government can't overspend in the future. People, the government can overspend all at once in the future. Balanced means that the government spends as much as it wants and then takes all it needs from you to balance out. It has nothing to do with if you don't cap what the budget is going to be based on, say, the previous year, it can only grow at 0.5%. The other thing is in the bill, it said, well, it can't exceed 20% of gross domestic product. Okay, what if we have a really, really good year, Paula? All of a sudden, the economy's booming. What does that say? The government can now just spend out of control right on up to this new limit. And if the tax revenue isn't there, then they have to raise taxes. See, this is what they want you to believe. If taxes coming in add up to, we'll just say, $5 trillion, money coming in adds up to $5 trillion, then the only thing the government can spend is $5 trillion. Not true. The government can spend $10 trillion. And then this constitutional amendment will require them to raise taxes. And guess what our Democrat and Republican so-called leaders will do? They will hold up their hands and go, that's not our constitutional amendment that you, the states, you, the people, ratified. We're forced to raise your taxes. We have no choice in it. There's no control on spending whatsoever. Constitutional amendment to balance the budget in itself has no control over spending. And that's what the Republicans, thank you, Republican Party, party that I'm a member of, just try to do to us. Unlimited spending, literally, with very little controls and definitely putting the cart before the horse. It the way it read, it said that revenues must match spending. Okay. But it didn't say that spending can't come first. Spending, they can spend. And you see the trickery, the parliamentary trickery that they've used already under Nancy Pelosi to say, well, we can't agree on a budget, so we will pass a bill that says that we assume we have a budget, and now that we assume we've had a budget, we will assume that we've passed the budget even though we haven't. Now we can start spending. And that's what they did. The Senate hasn't passed a budget in something like over 800 days now. You know, years. Over 3 years, 3.5 years, they have not passed a budget. So Congress has, but it has to pass in the Senate as well. So we have not had a national budget for years, and we are required by the Constitution to have a national budget, and yet we haven't had one. So, I take that back. The Constitution doesn't require a budget, but there is legislation that requires a budget. So the bottom line is this balanced budget amendment – our representatives were buffaloing us. And if you have a representative that said, hey, look, I voted for the balanced budget amendment, there were four Republican congressmen that voted against it, one of which was Paul Ryan. We know that he's pretty much a financial, very smart guy, and budget, very smart guy. And he voted against it. And he said specifically in interviews, and I don't know if it was an editorial that he wrote, that his concern – well, it was just interviews, but it came out in a lot of different papers – that this doesn't really limit spending. And in fact, it forces the government to – doesn't force the government. It allows the government to tax us and say, hey, the Constitution requires it. We have to raise taxes on you. But doesn't put any limits or only the 20% GDP. limit on spending, and 20% is fairly high. That's not where we want to be. We want to be a little bit lower than that. So that's the balanced budget amendment. Okay, let's talk about Obama and the libtards' balanced approach. We now have, as a nation, over $15 trillion in debt. We've been spending money the last several years like drunken sailors. The government says now to fix that, we need a balanced approach. We not only need to cut government spending, but that will occur over 10 years. But we need to raise your taxes now, right now, immediately. Got to raise them. And they say only on rich people. Hold on just a second, Paula. Tell one more joke.
Oh, I would love to, except I don't have it
okay.
in front
Hold
of me.
Hold on a second. I'm going to pause here for just a second. Hey, can you turn that down just a little bit? Okay, I had to make sure that my cell phone was starting to go off. That I don't know if you could hear it, but I had to turn that down. Okay, so so the balanced approach is government has done a crappy job of spending our money and going into debt. There's no doubt about it. We're in debt. It doesn't matter. You can say, oh, it was all Bush's fault. Oh, it was all George Washington's fault. Oh, it was Lincoln's fault. I don't really care whose fault it was. It was government that did it. I don't care who it was. It was government. I'm not government. Are you government? Nope. Government failed us. So what's government's approach? Well, now it's got to be a balanced approach. Now, I'm going to explain to people why that balanced approach is not just going after the rich. Oh, let's go after the big evil corporations and all the rich people. We could take 100% of all the money of all the rich, and it will not make a dent in the national debt. It won't even cover half of our annual deficit. In other words, the rate at which we're going into debt. So how are our genius legislators going to use a balanced approach? Well, Paula, they keep talking about we've got to close the loopholes. What's a loophole?
I wish I could something about one way around to the other.
Well, we're talking about here's a personal loophole. If you own a house and you have a mortgage, you get to deduct the interest. That reduces your personal income, and thereby your tax rate. If you can get your income, you can deduct all kinds of things. Your income gets lower and lower. Look at GE, a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar corporation, and they pay no taxes the last couple of years because they have all kinds of deductions they take, so-called loopholes. So let's see how the middle class ends up paying for all these loopholes, both personal and corporate. We've talked about this on the show before, but I'm going to go over it very briefly. Corporate taxes, the taxes that corporations pay, they don't pay taxes. Taxes are an expense. They roll that into the price of their product. Now, if you go to the grocery store, Paula, the profit margin, that's the word I'm looking for, profit margin that a grocery store gets might be 2 to 3%. It's very, very low on food. That's why grocery stores are starting to sell more and more things that have nothing to do with food, but, that's their profit margin on food. It's quite low. So if you were to say, we're going to raise corporate taxes 10%, would all grocery stores suddenly go out of business? Or would all grocery stores just start losing money? No. They'll still get a 2 to 3% profit margin. They will add 10%, the new tax hike, onto the cost of the food. So who ends up paying it? You and me. The big bad oil companies, oh, they get to deduct for this and that and the other thing that other industries do. Now, first of all, if you're going to say to the oil companies you can't deduct for drilling and then having a dry well, you spent the money in infrastructure and capital to drill in a spot and then you lost money on it, but you can't deduct that loss. But you go to other corporations and say you open a hotel over here and then nobody wants to stay in the hotel. You can now write that off as a loss. So, and that's not the greatest, but when you look at these specific industries that are manufacturing and oil in some regards can deduct some of the same deductions that manufacturing sector can, and there's overlap from different industries to different industries that the law allows. To close it on one industry but allow other industries to do it, first of all, I think is highly unethical, immoral, but also illegal, but they're going to do it anyway because of the big bad oil companies. So oil companies generally have a profit margin of 8 to 10%. So if we start closing these loopholes, is their profit margin going to dwindle to 5%, 4%, 3%, 2%? No. They just raised the price of oil, price of gasoline. So who ends up paying it? The government? No. Government doesn't pay anything. We pay. Anything the government pays is us, taxpayer. So when corporations' loopholes are closed because they're big, bad, and evil and they're making way too much money, they don't pay it. We do, Paula. So there's the corporation aspect. This is how you get at the middle class. The bulk of the money being made and saved and spent and on are not the rich people of our country. Even though the rich people already pay the largest percentage of the total amount of money for taxes, income taxes, the bulk of the money, way more income is coming into the middle class of America and small businesses than all of the rich people combined. Because think about it. If you're rich, Paula, do you have to work? No. You don't work anymore. You invest your money. All the money you earned, you invest. And typically investments are taxed at a lower rate. But what the government is saying, oh, no, all these rich people are, you know, investing, and their investments are only taxed at, you know, capital gains 15%. We need to raise the capital gains because these rich people are getting away with lower taxes. First of all, the money they earned to then invest, they paid personal income tax. And now all of the investing is getting them capital gains and dividends, et cetera, that they pay a lower tax rate. In many cases, 15% might be higher, but it's certainly not at the personal income tax. Some things are. Okay, so that's double taxation, really, what it is. The same money that got taxed as personal income then gets taxed as capital gains. So we're getting more than 35% out of them. We're getting, you know, 50% out of them. But that's not enough. And we're demonizing them. But here's the real important part of it. You've heard me say the word investing, Paula, numerous times. The rich people that don't have to work, the only way they get income is by investing their money. And what are they investing it in? Are they investing in other rich people? Are they investing it in hiding under mattress? No, they're investing it in, guess what? Oil companies, small businesses, entrepreneurs, capital investment, venture capital. I've looked at some companies when I've looked at a couple opportunities in the past that are venture capital. There's a ton of money out there, and there are a lot of people that are rich that are willing to invest their money in risky areas, venture capital, with the chance of getting a big payback. So we're talking about trying to grow our economy and improve the unemployment rate, and we want people to invest in the future and infrastructure and small businesses and big businesses. That's what we want. That's what our president will tell us. And yet we're going to go after those very people because they're evil for investing and then making money. Okay, so that's the corporation aspect of it. Now let's talk about the personal aspect of it. We want to close the loopholes, Paula. And the, one of the loopholes I mentioned was your mortgage interest. What about when you donate to a charitable organization? You get to write that off in your taxes as well. And there are other things that you can write off on your taxes. But in order to simplify, this is in the name of simplifying the tax code, we're going to eliminate all that. But don't worry, don't worry. We're going to lower your taxes. I can tell you right now, Paula, if, say, somebody is paying 20% income tax rate based on the income they have today, but with the deductions they're able to take. Without the deductions, they might be paying 27%. But with the deductions, they're down to 20%. The government is going to eliminate all of those deductions, but cut your 27%. This is what they're going to say. We're going to cut your tax rate. It's not going to be 27% anymore. It's going to be 22%. But what's the net effect? With my deductions, I was getting down to 20%. But with the simplifying of the tax code, because we all like simple, 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 it's actually going to go up to 22% without the deductions. That's another way they're going to get the massive middle class. The massive middle class is going to pay more taxes. On every corporate tax that goes up and every corporate loophole that is closed, we'll pay those taxes. And on our own personal taxes, I guarantee every listener out there, look what you paid in personal income tax. If you have a steady salary or you're earning a steady wage over the last few years, look at what you paid last year and the year before. Next year, if they, quote, simplify the tax code and your so-called tax rate goes down, you will be paying more. It will go up, absolutely go up, okay? So that's what's going to happen. That's how they're going to get the middle class. They're going to go through corporations by raising their taxes and closing loopholes, and they're going to go to us and close our loopholes, so-called loopholes, in the name of simplifying the tax code. We are going to be paying more and more and more because that's where the bulk of the money is. You can only go push so far the rich people. They'll get their money out of the country. Well, first of all, Paula, if you had $10 million in the bank, $10 million in the bank, and in a bank account that earned no interest, and you said, if I'm careful, I can live the rest of my life on that $10 million. Actually, you might not even have to be that careful, but you're not earning any interest on it. You'd pay no taxes. But guess what? You're rich. You've got $10 million in the bank. Well, I earned it, and I already paid taxes on it. I don't care. You're rich, and we got to figure out some way to get that from you. But that's what you saved your whole life, and you're going to live off of it. You're not making any money whatsoever. The government wants to figure out how to get your money when you're not even earning money anymore.
They always, no matter what you do.
Exactly. And one of our Democrat, I can't remember his name now, what a moron, he wants to tax every transaction. So in other words, when American Airlines sends me a check for my monthly pay, that's a transaction. That'll get taxed. There'll be a 1% fee on that. And then when I want to take any money out of my checking account, I pay 1% every time I take it out.
Yeah.
And if I deposit some money, let's say I take it out and they go, oh, I don't need to use this, and I put it back in, I pay another 1%. That's how they're going to get middle-class America. It won't affect the rich. And here's the thing about it. This is the irony of it. Every time a libtard says, oh, but the rich can afford it. You're right, the rich can, but the middle class can't. And that's who you're really affecting. You're going after them. All of this stuff about we're just going to go after big bad corporations and close all the loopholes, it all goes straight to the middle class. It affects not the rich at all. It affects not corporations at all. It's going after the middle class because they're the big dog. They're the ones with all the money. There's so many of us. That's the thing. We may not be rich, but there's so many of us, that's where all the money is, and that's who they're coming after. Okay, so there you go. This is the balanced approach. We've got to raise more money, and we're going to do it in those ways. There's nothing else they're talking about. Obama's jobs bill isn't a jobs bill. It doesn't create any jobs whatsoever. It spends money and spends money on so-called infrastructure. Remember, now it's about investing. Before, it was stimulus. We're going to stimulate the economy with shovel-ready jobs. But there were no shovel-ready jobs. But that's, if you read the bill, that's exactly what it's going to do. It's going to spend money on the so-called shovel-ready jobs again when there are no shovel-ready jobs. In fact, I don't remember if we played this last time. You know what I'm going to play, right?
Yes, I do. It means a whole
I think we can get a lot of work done fast. When I met with the governors, all of them have projects that are shovel-ready. We've got shovel-ready projects all across the country. Shovel-ready projects, rebuilding our roads, our bridges. We are seeing shovels hit the ground. Shovels are breaking ground. There are almost 100 shovel-ready transportation projects already approved in Colorado, which are beginning to create jobs.
Except it wasn't true. The liar-in-chief, let's hear what the liar-in-chief had to actually say after making all those promises about shovel-ready jobs. What did the liar-in-chief had to say?
Shovel-ready was not as shovel-ready as we expected. Shovel-ready was not as shovel-ready as we expected.
Oh, it's so funny. Let's laugh about it. Yeah, it's funny. What a joke. Yeah, we were just kidding around about those shovel-ready jobs. Although I promised you guys, we'll just laugh it off. And that's what's going on now. His so-called jobs bill doesn't create one single job. And then today, he had the gall to stand up there and say and try and take credit for a bill that passed in the House and Senate that is going to, quote, incentivize employers to hire veterans out of work. Now,
right.
If you're a veteran out of work, it's because you don't have a skill that somebody wants and needs. Or people just don't need extra help right now. But what is this great, wonderful plan that he talked about today going to do for veterans? It's not going to get one veteran hired. If I need somebody to work for me, I'm hiring them. Not based on this incentive. It's a $2,500 tax credit. Tax credit. $2,500. Paula, you know how much it costs to hire somebody nowadays full-time? It probably costs an individual company anywhere from, depending on who the company is and, you know, what the job is, it can cost $30,000 to $50,000 in benefits, vacation, matching 401k, on and on and on. So you need to have somebody that's going to be productive and get something done for you. If you don't need, if you don't have a significant need, if it's not going to make your business more profitable, you're not going to hire. That's why nobody's hiring. A $2,500 tax credit is meaningless. This guy is so incompetent. He thinks something like this will make a difference. I'm all for helping out veterans out of work. Absolutely. This is a joke. It's a scam. It's a sham. It's a lie. It will not create any new veteran jobs. And then on top of it, and I can say this because I'm a veteran, why are we doing this just for veterans? Why? Why aren't we doing this for all Americans? There are a lot of Americans out of work. How come just veterans?
Maybe because it's going to make him look good in the polls next year.
Yeah, it does. It makes. He hopes it will make him look good, even though, and he can talk about it. Oh, I signed a bill that, you know, helped create more veterans jobs. We'll prove it. Show me the jobs that it created. No employer is going to say, let's see, I'm going to get a $2,500 tax credit if I expend $50,000 hiring somebody that I don't really need. Now, on the other hand, there's no tax credit, and I really need somebody. I need to hire somebody, and this veteran over here is qualified. I need somebody because my business is going to be more productive, and I'm going to have more revenue. I hire him. $2,500 is meaningless, absolutely meaningless in a business environment, even a small business environment. It's meaningless. So here he is trying to take credit for something that is meaningless. The guy is incompetent. And here's another example of why he's so incompetent. And we played this. I love this one. This is a good one.
Good afternoon, everybody. Aloha. One other thing that I want to say about this. When I meet with world leaders, what's striking, whether it's in Europe or here in Asia, or here in Asia, or here in Asia, or here in Asia.
What he should have said is, when I meet with other world leaders, it's striking how stupid I am, how incompetent I am, and how over my head I am, and I have no idea what they're talking about, because I've never done anything in my life. That's what he really should have said. But, yeah, aloha, everybody here in Hawaii. And, by the way, right here in Asia, yeah, right. We all make mistakes, but this guy, he didn't make that mistake till he went off the teleprompter. Once he wasn't reading what somebody handed him, now, I'm sorry, he wasn't on the teleprompter, but he was reading. It was clear if you watched the video, he was reading. So, anyway, okay. I think we've hammered that pretty heavily about the government's balanced approach. The government has been completely imbalanced in the way it has spent our money and driven us into debt. And now it wants us to balance things out. And yet, it's not really actually going to make any cuts. All of these cuts they're talking about making are over 10 years, but the spending will continue today, immediately. And taxes will kick in immediately, and you will start losing more of your money and wealth immediately. But the cuts, they'll come over 10 years. And then the next Congress will just eliminate those cuts. But you'll keep spending more money, and government will stay the same size. So that's pretty much what's going to happen. Now, Obamacare. What happens if the Supreme Court rules that it's constitutional? I don't know which way I'm going to go with this. First of all, I guess what I'm going to do is say, I talked with my good friend Dion Long last night, because I have had an epiphany about something, and I said it earlier in the show. If the Supreme Court rules that Obamacare is constitutional, they have just basically cut themselves off at the knees, and they are no longer a valid separate power and entity in the federal government and no longer have any meaning whatsoever. And I'll explain that in a moment. But when I brought this up with Dion, and he's one of the smartest guys I know when it comes to the Constitution, he made a really good point, something I had actually not thought about. But it's a really simple, simple point. If Obamacare is ruled constitutional, and so the government can proceed forward with making you buy something that you have no intention of buying, in other words, engaging in economic activity. In the past, they could control your economic activity. Now they can control your lack of economic activity, your lack of decision-making, or your decision-making to make you come up to a particular conclusion. Okay, what Dion said was, it may be constitutional, but that doesn't mean the government has to enforce it. In other words, if we retain a Republican majority in the House and take back the Senate, and a Republican is elected president, we can repeal Obamacare. It doesn't matter if it's constitutional or not. The problem in the future is, eventually, when things swing the other way to Democrats, they can just reinstate it. So it can just keep coming back and forth, back and forth. We need to ensure that it's deemed unconstitutional so it just can't come back. But let me explain why it's unconstitutional. And this is a way of doing this that you're never, ever going to hear anywhere else. So listen closely. Here is the Commerce Clause. The Congress has the authority to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. Now, we can talk all day about what the intent was, but I'm going to explain what the intent is. Now, libs out there are like, well, Tom, you know, the intent has got to change with the times and on and on and on. I'm going to explain why it doesn't. Let me read another enumerated power. And if you don't know what an enumerated power is, it's a specific power. In other words, you have this power, and that's it. And the 10th Amendment makes it clear. Congress, the president, the judiciary have specific powers. If it doesn't say it in the Constitution, you can't do it. Okay. But let's see what other specific powers our founders outlined to ensure that Congress could get things done it needs to get done. So they had to spell them out, because if they didn't spell them out, then Congress can't do them. Here's one, Paula. To raise and support armies. Now, wait a minute. Does raising and supporting armies affect interstate commerce? Yes, it does. Well, the Commerce Clause already covers that, according to the Supreme Court today. To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. Does that affect interstate commerce? Yeah, that stuff affects interstate commerce. Well, the Commerce Clause covers that, according to the Supreme Court. Let's see. To declare war. Does declaring war affect interstate commerce? Absolutely. Well, then why did our founders spell all of these things out if that one clause, the Commerce Clause, covered everything? Because it wasn't intended to. It could not have possibly been intended to. Otherwise, they wouldn't have spelled all these other things out. They could have just said to regulate commerce with the several among the several states. And that covers everything. You're done. Go home. We're done. Great. Nice short constitution. One sentence. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at some things that maybe the president has authority to do. Here's one. The president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties. Now, what are treaties? Well, they're agreements with other nations. Do these treaties affect interstate commerce? Most of them do. Well, wait a minute. The Congress has the authority to control treaties because the Commerce Clause. The Congress does because they affect interstate commerce. Well, wait a minute. But it says the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now we have conflicting powers. We don't have a separation of powers anymore. Congress can say, no, the treaty that the president put to the Senate and the Senate agreed to and now has been signed between the United States and China is invalid because we, the Congress, get to control interstate commerce, all interstate commerce, and we say no to that. But the Constitution doesn't say Congress gets to get involved in treaties. But now, under the Commerce Clause, it does. So now here's where, when I said that the Supreme Court is basically nullifying itself, think of it this way. If the Supreme Court rules that the federal government, i.e. Congress, has the authority to control all forms of commerce and lack of commerce, their ruling affects commerce. In other words, their ruling will affect the future of commerce in this country, and therefore the Congress can control their ruling. In the past, in order to overturn a Supreme Court ruling, it took the Supreme Court to go back and revisit and overturn it, or a constitutional amendment. We no longer need constitutional amendments, Paula, if the Supreme Court rules on this in the affirmative. Constitutional amendments anymore. Because the Congress now controls all commerce, all potential commerce, all future commerce, all consideration of commerce, and every Supreme Court ruling from here to eternity will in some way affect commerce, and the Congress, with simple legislation, can overturn every Supreme Court ruling. So if the Supreme Court rules in the affirmative on this, they have just nullified themselves for the future to infinity. Now let's go back and revisit a ruling by the Supreme Court called Roe v. Wade. a woman's right to privacy, a woman's right to decide to have an abortion. Do having abortions affect interstate commerce? In many ways, the woman's going to have to go to a doctor. Even if it's underground, she's going to have to pay somebody. She's going to have some recuperation time, have some antibiotics. Interstate commerce. Also, that child is never going to see the light of day, and that child would have been a contributor to the tax base in the future, most likely. Or that child would have been a burden on society and a drain on the tax system. That abortion just affected interstate commerce, and now with simple legislation, Congress can say all abortions are illegal. And the Supreme Court can't say boo-hoo because the Supreme Court just gave them the authority to do that. Now let's go back to one more ruling. Dred Scott in the 1800s, after the Civil War. The Supreme Court ruled that blacks were never intended to have citizenship. And so how did Congress get around that? A simple piece of legislation? No, legislation wouldn't work because they can't overturn the Supreme Court legislation. That's how we got the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment says anybody born in this country under the jurisdiction of this nation, in other words, and all of the children of original slaves would have fallen under the jurisdiction of the United States of America, that they are citizens. Do you know, Paula, that the Dred Scott ruling that blacks were never intended to have citizenship has never been overturned? The Supreme Court has never gone back and overturned its own ruling. It is still a standing ruling today. But the reason it doesn't matter or apply is because we amended the Constitution, and the Constitution is the law of the land. When the day comes that the Supreme Court rules that the Commerce Clause trumps everything else in the Constitution, it also trumps the Supreme Court. So the word needs to get out on this, and if the Supreme Court justices have any brains whatsoever, they will rule that Obamacare is unconstitutional. Otherwise, they don't matter anymore in the future. They will never matter anymore. And in fact, the president won't matter anymore. His executive orders won't matter. And they really, quite honestly, don't matter now. But it'll be even easier for Congress to trump the other branches and take over their powers because of the Commerce Clause. Does it make sense?
It does, and it's unfortunate that it's not. I don't think that a lot of people are aware of what effect it does have, because I just came across a piece here posted today on redstate.com. It's called Commerce Clause Frivolity, Obamacare, NASA, and Your Unwed Pregnant Daughter. And in it, it touches several pieces upon what you had just discussed. Mm-hmm. It goes on to say, you know, 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court agreed to decide the constitutionality of President Obama's signature piece of legislation, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. In a surprising act of courage, the court agreed to decide the divisive case in the midst of what will certainly be one of the most viscerally contentious elections in a century. And that, you know, what you discussed, Tom, is I don't believe that there are a lot of people in the country that understand that. What effect does Obamacare have on the upcoming election?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. They don't understand. This is the only reason I ran for Congress was I saw this was coming, and I thought I could make a difference, one, if I got elected, because then I would actually have a public speaking forum, a forum that would have some credibility, and not just as a candidate running around, but I could get up in front of the news media on a regular basis and talk about these things. But when I would go around and talk to various groups, I would say, what's the worst part of Obamacare? And they would say different things. They'd pick out specific details that might have something to do with Medicare or other things. I said, no, it destroys the Constitution. And Thomas Jefferson said it best. When he was talking about the General Welfare Clause, they had no idea the Commerce Clause was going to be the trump card. But it's the same exact concept, using a clause like this to control everything. And he said, it reduces the whole instrument, talking about the Constitution, it reduces the whole instrument, that of a single phrase, constituting a Congress with the power to do whatever would be for the good of the Union. And as they would be the sole judges of good and evil, they will also have the power to do whatever evil they choose. And back earlier in the statement, he talks about under the general welfare clause, that it's really a general welfare clause is not that Congress gets to decide what the welfare and general welfare of our nation is. They can tax us to provide for it. If you look at the preamble to the Constitution, and I'll run through that very quickly here, and I'm going to do this from memory, because I got my Constitution here, but I'm going to do this from memory. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Did you hear that? Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The preamble says promote. Promotion is going around saying, rah, 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 general welfare, go for it, good, good, good. It's not actual action. It's putting a poster on a wall. Hey, go, 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 general welfare. But it does say in the enumerated powers of Congress that they get to tax us to provide, one, for the common defense, and two, the general welfare. I would argue that Obamacare is specific welfare. It's very specific and specifically targeted. But you could say, you could argue that, well, it may be specific in that it's health care, but it does change the overall welfare of the entire nation. Okay, good. But remember what the article says. I think it's Section 8, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 1, says that they may tax us to provide for the general welfare. It doesn't say they get to control it, they get to decide it, they get to take over industry, they get to control every aspect. It doesn't say that. So the general welfare clause, initially, when Obamacare was being proposed, people said, oh, they're going to use the general welfare clause. That's what they're going to do to prove its constitutionality. Uh-uh, it won't work. It won't work. What will work, though, is the Commerce Clause, because here's what's happened. Federal judges have admitted, have openly spoken about this and said that through their legislation, both federal circuit court judges, courts of appeals, and the Supreme Court have expanded the power of Congress under the Commerce Clause. Now, there is nothing in the Constitution under the judiciary that says they have the power to expand another branch of power. Nothing. Remember the concept of separation of powers? If there's a separation of powers, then the president, the legislature, and the judiciary cannot expand the power of another branch of government. The only way to expand the power of any branch of government is the amendment process. So yes, the legislature can propose a constitutional amendment like they just most recently did, that ugly balanced budget amendment, but then it has to go to the states for ratification. The Supreme Court can't propose any amendments to the Constitution, and the president can only recommend. And yet these judges have openly discussed and admitted that they themselves have expanded the power of Congress. They don't have the authority. They violated the Constitution, and they violated their oaths of office in doing so. Now, somebody would say, well, Tom, they're just interpreting. Look, I just explained. How can anybody with one single brain cell interpret the Commerce Clause to mean that it can control every aspect of commerce, which is what? A financial transaction. Not only do they get to control the financial transaction, they now get to control the manufacture, the transport, the decision to buy, the decision not to buy, every aspect that revolves around commerce. How can anybody come to that conclusion when that assumption, that now interpretation, eliminates the need for all other enumerations of power and now starts to encroach and impede on the other branches' power? How could anybody ever come to that conclusion? Because they have an agenda and they don't care. And what we're going to find is there's going to be some smart congressman that's going to propose some legislation that's going to be completely unconstitutional, and he's going to say, under the Commerce Clause, we can do this. And everybody goes, hey, that's a great idea. We never could have done that before, but thanks to the Supreme Court now we can do it.
Right, and a perfect example would be what they had put in this particular article was they said that the central question in the case is a relatively straightforward one. Does the federal government under the Commerce Clause have the power to force Americans to purchase health insurance? And it states Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states with the Indian tribes. So it goes on to say that the foundation for the administration's argument that it does indeed have that power lay in a case handed down by the Supreme Court in 1942, Wickford v. Filburn. That case gave the stamp of approval to the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, which allowed the federal government to regulate economic activity.
Yep.
And in that case, in 1940, what occurred was that an Ohio farmer grew more wheat than the government allotment allowed, and they fined him for it. So he turns around, sues them, stating that his wheat was for his own use on his farm, and therefore was beyond congressional reach. In a legal gerrymander, that would put any politician to shame. The court decided that as Filburn's exceeding his quotas would result in him buying less wheat in local markets, which in turn led to less wheat traded in those markets, he was impacting interstate commerce. Therefore, Congress did indeed have the power to limit his production. So twisting Filburn's already tortured logic, the Obama administration has decided that now it can force all Americans to purchase health care. The why is that society has to pick up the tab when uninsured people go to the emergency room. The how is where Filburn comes in. By virtue of the fact that the money people spend on health care for the uninsured through higher taxes and higher insurance premiums cannot be spent to purchase goods and services they might otherwise purchase. Healthcare impacts interstate commerce. Congress has the power to regulate healthcare and can compel people to purchase health insurance. And that is the logic the Democrats used as they force-fed Obamacare down the throats of the American people.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And I want to clarify, I mean, you did a good job of portraying that. This Filburn-Wickham in 1942 ruling basically said, for real simplistic purposes, by not selling your wheat and withholding it from the market, you've affected interstate commerce because there would be more wheat on the market and the price might be lower. Therefore, we can tax you on the wheat that you're not even selling. In other words, I'm not selling it, but we're going to tax you on it. So you could take that to an extreme. I'm sitting on my patio carving a wood cane, and the government can come along and say, are you going to sell that? No, but we're going to tax you on it. It's just a stick of wood I got out of the woods, and I'm carving on it. Yeah, you're making it into a cane, and it looks pretty nice, and we're going to tax you as if you were an entrepreneur selling stuff. But I'm not. Sorry, too bad. And some people would argue, okay, so the argument at the time was he engaged in activity growing wheat. He just didn't sell it, but he did engage in activity. The argument now is, stretching that, you're not engaging in activity. But even though you're not engaging in activity, you might be one day, and therefore we're going to get you. Let's say I'm a healthy person, and I have a family history of no health issues, and I just don't want health insurance, Paula. If I choose not to have health insurance, and I never get sick, and I never go to a hospital, and if I did, I pay out of my pocket, but if I never go and then don't have the money to pay, ever,
right.
Can the government predict that there will be people that will never need health care? No, they can't. They can't with certainty.
But
they're saying it doesn't matter. We're going to make everybody pay whether you're ever going to need it or not, because the odds are you will, and you won't be able to pay out of your pocket. We don't care.
I feel that should only be for the children up until a specific age. My personal feeling, I don't feel that should be imposed on the adults in the country to have health insurance.
The other thing, Paula. It's a state issue. It's not a federal issue. Each state should be handling that, not the federal government. The federal government has no authority under the Constitution to handle these kind of issues. None. Zero. Like I said, the only thing they can do is tax us. They could say, listen, like Social Security, for example. FDR said, it's an insurance program. Don't worry, it's an insurance program. You're putting money into a program, and your money's there, when in fact that was a lie. Your money's going to somebody else. It's a Ponzi scheme.
And that was
your money's going to somebody else. But
that was supposed to be short term, wasn't it, Tom?
I don't know about that. No, I don't think so. But what happened was when the opponents to that took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took it up, FDR's lawyers, the Attorney General office, for the government said, oh, no, no, this isn't an insurance plan, because the federal government has no authority to mandate an insurance program. And that's what healthcare is. It's a mandated insurance program. So where they're doing the same thing. They're saying, oh, no, no, this is not an insurance program. This is a tax. Remember, it's a penalty if you don't participate. It's not a tax. A tax would be every American who earns money will pay a percentage to the program. That's what Social Security is. So FDR told the public in public radio addresses, it's an insurance program. Don't worry, it's not a tax. But when it was argued before the Supreme Court, the justice lawyer said, oh, no, it's not an insurance program. It's a tax. So there was the first lie, the big lie, of a liberal socialistic Democrat. And now we have another one who's doing the same thing. Remember, Obama went around the country saying, oh, no, it's not a penalty. It's not a tax. It's not a tax. Only those that don't comply will be penalized. But now when they argue before the Supreme Court, it's no longer a penalty. Oh, it's just a tax. It's a tax on everybody. Wait a minute. It's not a tax on me. If I have health insurance through my employer, I'm not paying a tax. But the person who is self-employed and doesn't purchase insurance, now he's taxed. That is not equal distribution. That is not any kind of equal taxation whatsoever. It's not random, but it's specific to being a penalty. It's an absolute penalty. So they've lied to us about what it actually is, just like FDR lied about Social Security. The federal government has no authority to have a federally mandated insurance program. And that's why FDR couldn't argue that it was insurance. But now we've gone so far down the road with rulings like the Filburn-Wickham ruling that says if you engage in activity, we can tax it. Now, if you don't engage in activity, we can tax it. And think of the implications of that, Paula. What if I don't buy an American-made car because I don't want an American-made car? Can the government now say, well, you're engaging in economic activity by buying a Lexus or a Toyota or a Nissan, and we can now control that. You now have to buy a Chevy. And not only are we going to tell you to buy a Chevy, it's going to be a Chevy Volt. Oh, gosh. Not for me. But that's where we're going now. Now they can do. And we remember we did that whole segment called Commander Garcia Back from the Future on where this legislation will ultimately lead us. It will lead us to really a highly controlled communist society, just like the old Soviet Russia or the less capitalized China. Or Cuba today, where the government controls everything. And you get in line, wait for your food, and if we run out, sorry, come back tomorrow. And we're all going to wear the same uniform, so we all look alike. That way there can't be any discrimination, and on and on and on. The government will control everything. And 40 years from now, we'll look back on it and go, how did we get here? Oh, yeah, it was that pesky little Commerce Clause. Commerce and the Supreme Court going way beyond their authority, violating the Constitution themselves, by claiming that the Commerce Clause now means something new, and it means that Congress has all the power. And then when the Supreme Court needs to someday step in and say, no, Congress has overstepped its bounds, no, we haven't. Under the Commerce Clause, we can do anything, and you gave us that ruling. So there's the danger, and that's what we're facing. That's why it's got to be overturned.
And the outcome of the administration's logic suggests that there is nothing in our 14, well, as of this writing, it was 14, but we're going past the $15 trillion economy that could not be said to impact interstate commerce. Growing tomatoes in your backyard rather than buying them in the supermarket, staying at home instead of going out to the movies, sewing the hole in a child's pants rather than buying a new pair, sending your kid to a private or religious school rather than the dysfunctional public school down the street.
Yep.
This is what we're being. It's as if we're being cornered to. And I haven't finished the last two or three sentences, but this is where yours and mine's and say the middle class. This is where we're being pigeonholed. Is don't go out and buy anything. Don't do anything. Don't whatever, and you're going to be part of the haves and have-nots. If this expansion of the absurd logic of Filburn is allowed to stand, there will be literally nothing the government cannot make you do or keep you from doing. At that point, there will be no freedom left in America.
Yeah, first, that's what Jefferson said in his statement, and that's what I was saying literally 3 years ago when I was warning people about the coming Obama administration legislation. for Obamacare. Here's an interesting take on it, and this is what I used to use a few years ago. Paula, if you go to church every Sunday, and you spend more than most people would at church, maybe you spend a whole half day there because you're involved in a lot of different activities. Maybe your church, you know, has all kinds of different things scheduled throughout the day, and you're there more than the average American or most Americans every Sunday.
Right.
Have you impacted interstate commerce? Yes, you have.
Because
you're not at the mall buying something when you're at church for 6 hours. You're not selling something. You're not buying something on the internet. You're not at work working. You have impacted interstate commerce with your church-going activities. And now, under what the Supreme Court is talking about, or the libtards that want the Supreme Court to authorize this, the government now can control your church-going activities. Now, the libtards would say, oh, no, Tom, separation of church and state. First of all, there's no statement of separation of church and state in the Constitution. It says that the Congress or the federal government shall make no laws respecting the establishment of a religion. Well, your religion's already established. You're already going. This has nothing to do with an establishing a religion or telling what church to go to. It's just that if you go to a church that you spend too much time at, you're affecting interstate commerce, and we're going to tell you you can't go for 6 hours every Sunday. You can only go for three. That's where this is all going. And again, we've talked about this many, many times. These liberal idiots will say, Tom, it'll never happen. Never happen, huh? Never happen. Yeah, go and talk to the people in Venezuela. Oh, we'll never end up with a dictator. Oh, no, it'll never happen, Tom. Yeah, you got Chavez. The only way they're going to get rid of him is with his cancer. And good riddance on that one. But
that's what people don't realize. The first thing to go will be what's left of the economic freedom, followed shortly thereafter by political and then religious freedoms. And that's what people don't realize. And once those are gone, how much is really left of America at all? And people will go, well, you know, it's people like you that are, you know, on your rants and your tears and da-da-da and this and that. Well, you know what? Wake up and pay attention, because whether it's the federal or the state, they're telling you that you have to wear your seatbelt in your car, and, you know, there's certain things that you can't do and that you're not allowed to do, and that's what people are not realizing. It's not so much of, well, you know, if it's a brainwashing thing. No. Wake up and pay attention to what's going on. And if you really want some serious education besides sitting down in front of the computer and, you know, spending money on stuff that you don't have, I recently, you know, on the other side of this, I recently picked up The Penguin Guide to the United States Constitution. It's a fully annotated Declaration of Independence, U.S. Constitution and Amendments, and selection from the Federalist Papers. And it's by a gentleman by the name of Professor Richard Beeman. He's known across the country for his appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he's one of the nation's foremost experts on the United States Constitution. The book produced what every American should have. It's better than, I was looking for one called Constitution for Dummies, and I happened upon this book instead. Honest to God, Tom, one of the best things I could ever read. Any American should pick this up. It's a couple of bucks. You can pick it up on Amazon. It's produced, it's a compact, fully annotated copy of the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the amendments, and everything in their entirety.
Awesome.
The guide features a history of the making of the Constitution with excerpts from the Federalist Papers, and a look at crucial Supreme Court cases that remind us that the meaning of many of the specific provisions of the Constitution has changed over time. And I honest to God, I could be one person or one of many, that people in this country are in a fog. They'll go on their rants on Facebook and Twitter about how we should change things. Things should have changed a long, long time ago, and people should have paid attention instead of just walking into a booth and checking off whoever looked good, whatever name looked good, whoever, you know. No, do your research, listen to what's going on, follow the debates. Follow every debate, make the time to follow the debate, and voice your opinion when it comes to the voting time. It's very simple.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, I agree. Well, what was the name of that book again?
This book, the name of this book is called The Penguin Guide to the United States Constitution.
Awesome.
And Amazon has it for $9.60.
Wow, that's awesome. That really is.
You know, yeah. And I love books, and I'm not, you know, I love history, but like I said, because of, you know, what we do here on the show and the specifics that you get into with things, Tom, I figured, well, you know, I better brush up on my learning, you know, understanding the Constitution. So I went to go look for Constitution for Dummies. They didn't have Constitution for Dummies. They had this book, and I went, that's a cute one. Not the one by its cover, but I started reading it, and I went, you know what? It's really, really good. It's very descriptive, and it does what I need it to do, and I think every American should have this book. I really do. This is something they should put in all the schools, Tom.
This
is a book that they should have in all the schools.
They should, but we don't want, remember, our schools are run by union members, union people, and they don't want our kids understanding the Constitution. Really, I'm ashamed to say it. I'm a member of a union. I've been a member of a union for 20 years now, and not my union, but other unions. I almost said something I shouldn't have said, but other unions out there, those folks have turned into communists and socialists. They really have no clue as to what runs an economy. They're workers. They're just workers. They just go to their job and do their job, and they know what they want, and they know what they want. And the company they work for is big, bad, and evil, and on, and they don't understand how a business works, how an economy works. And quite honestly, some of the jobs that these folks are doing, they're making way more money than they should. They're not skilled enough to be making that kind of money. But they're unionized, and they're able to squeeze that money out of the company. And the government is now very much on the side of these union thugs and what they want, and that's a danger to our nation. It's a threat to our nation. So I'm all for private unionization, but the government needs to get out of the business of regulating it, and we need to get away from all government unions. I wasn't allowed to unionize in the Navy, and our militaries don't unionize, and there's a reason for that. And if you want to work for the government, great, but you can't unionize. And the government has the authority to say, well, that's my constitutional right. You have no constitutional right to unionize. It's not a civil right. It's not a human right to unionize. If you want to work for the government, you're not going to be – look, first of all, federal employees in many cases can't unionize, and those that do can't negotiate and bargain for benefits and pay. They can only negotiate for safety issues and work rules. That's it. Now, through work rules, I know how it works because I've seen it firsthand. You can get more pay, but the bottom line is they can't. So, where's their constitution? Why aren't they all striking in there? Because we'll get rid of you and we'll replace you. That's why. So they don't get it. But along those lines, the union folks really want to see the Keystone Pipeline come into play. But what has our president done? He said, no, we're going to delay that till after the election.
Yeah.
Wow. So was that a political decision? Now we have the Secretary of Defense, Panetta, saying if Israel goes and bombs Iran, it could affect the price of oil. Because, you know, we rely on Iran for oil. Now, let me see. The Keystone Pipeline was going to eliminate at least 45% of our dependence on Iran. But no, we don't want that because we've got some environmentalists that say it's going to damage the environment. The first thing they say is all of that sand oil drilling is going to release a lot of CO2 in the air. Frankly, I think we need more CO2 in the air, and we've had too many shows on that. We need more CO2 in the air to slow down the impending and coming ice age. But at the same time, Canada's not going to stop their drilling. Oh, gee, you know, America won't buy our oil. Okay, let's go home. Let's pack up and go home. No, they're going to sell it to China. China's more than happy to buy that oil and at a higher price because it's got to be shipped all the way over to China. We were going to have a pipeline, just turn on the spigot. There it goes. No transportation costs there. Yeah, build the pipeline. All of those jobs were going to be created, not Canadian jobs because the pipeline's going to come all the way through the middle of the United States of America down to the oil shipping ports in Texas, or the refineries, rather, down to the refineries. And there's one other refinery somewhere along the way. I don't know if it's in Oklahoma or somewhere else in the Midwest that would also be stopping off at. No oil spill in North America ever has affected water aquifers, water tables, etc. They've all been extremely minor and none significant enough to affect that. Look at the kind of oil spills we have out in the Gulf. So now we're saying, oh, those Gulf drilling, yeah, that's really bad. So let's get a pipeline from Canada. Hey, and if Canada has a problem, hey, it's Canada. Let them spill all the oil they want on their own country. Won't be on us. No. So here's an editorial that I've written. I don't know if I should be reading this because it hasn't been published yet. It's being shopped around. But here it is. Veterans Day is a time to show our gratitude to the men and women who have valiantly served our country, many of whom have made the ultimate sacrifice. As a veteran of the United States Navy, I personally witnessed countless acts of courage during my time of service. I will forever value these servicemen and women's contributions to our national security. Unfortunately, this past Veterans Day marked a less than courageous act by the Obama administration, which does nothing to support or validate veterans' past efforts to protect our nation's economic and national security. On the very eve of Veterans Day, the State Department announced it will delay plans for the expansion of the Keystone XL pipeline, a project that will bring thousands of American jobs and help the U.S. become less reliant on hostile and unstable countries for our energy supplies. The Keystone XL pipeline would enable us to take advantage of neighboring Canada's vast petroleum resources and purchase more of our oil from an established friendly trade partner. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what Canada is. Okay. For the last 3 years, the State Department has conducted an exhaustive analysis of the project, including environmental reviews, exploration of route alternatives, and weighing the risks of any pipeline spill. In September, the State Department concluded this review and deemed the proposed pipeline safe. Now, outcry from environmental groups has superseded expert review and caused an uninformed or unfounded delay in moving this important project forward. Ultimately, it seems this decision was about politics and not about what is in the best interest of our country, for which I served. I strongly support the Keystone XL pipeline and encourage President Obama and his administration to reverse the decision to delay its approval. I also, and now that's the end of the editorial, I also called the White House today and left a message with one of the comment takers and said,
"You did."
If the president is concerned about election results and politics, there are a lot more people in this country that are concerned about national security than there are environmentalists. In fact, we have them outnumbered probably about 1,000,000 to 1. So if it's politics, he's on the wrong side of this issue. Also, if it's really about national security or anything else, he's also on the wrong side of it. And, you know, I told them that I'm a retired Navy commander, and I consider this a serious national security issue. And the lady was very nice. I'm sure they're told to be very nice, but she was very nice. She said, "Hey, those are some good points. I'm going to pass this on to the president today." I'm thinking, yeah, walk this on in. "Hey, this is from Commander Garcia, Mr. President. Here you go." Yeah, that's not going to happen. But, you know, it does matter. It does help. Maybe I'll be getting a call from the president tomorrow himself. "Hey, Tom, I heard that you're upset about the Keystone Pipeline." Like, "You haven't been listening to my show, have you?"
Country is in.
Yeah. So anyway, all right. Well, we covered a lot of ground today, Paula. Let's see. We may or may not be broadcasting on Wednesday. And I say that because I am now, if I haven't said it before, flying a new airplane and I'm on call. It's a good airplane. I'm glad to be have changed. It's an upgrade for me, but I don't have the luxury of the fantastic schedules I used to have. So I won't know until, you know, they call me and say, "Hey, you're going flying." And so I may or may not be flying. I may or may not be somewhere where I can do the show remotely, et cetera. So just stand by. I'll put it on the website if we're going to broadcast on Wednesday, or I'll at least put a note saying, you know, we don't know. Be flexible. Tune in by 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday. If it says we're a go, then we're a go. And that'll be the plan for Wednesday. And then next week, let's see, I am off Monday. And I believe Wednesday as well. I think Wednesday as well. So we'll be broadcasting next week. But we'll get that. I'll get that schedule on there. And then I've got a December schedule I'll be posting as well. And I'll send you a copy of that, Paula. But in any case, it's been fun. Any last thoughts or words, Paula?
Well, just that we should all pray for the safety of the men and women in service to our country every day that are coming home from Iraq. Extra prayers right now would be a good idea, and we want our patriot soldiers to come home safe. No family should lose one of our own in these final days. You know, continue to show appreciation to your veterans when you do see them, you know, even if it's just making eye contact or going up to them and shaking their hand and telling them, thank you very much for continuing to serve our country and fight for our liberties and our freedoms. It's truly appreciated. Your families love and miss you dearly and want you home real soon.
Absolutely. All right, Paula. Thanks. Well, thanks for joining me tonight, and thanks for the good humor at the beginning. And let me know when you finish that book, The Penguins. What you just sent me a The Penguins Guide to the Constitution. Excellent. So maybe when you get through that, we'll do a show where you're going to teach us some interesting aspects of the Constitution.
The layman's guide to the Constitution, huh?
Yes. The student will now be the master.
Deal.
All right. All right. Good night, Paula. We'll see you maybe on Wednesday, if not next Monday.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.